From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Santa Clara.
Santa Cruz.
Union City.
Hayward.
San Francisco.
I'm from Fremont.
Yo, I'm San Jose, just downtown.
Coming up, we'll go behind the scenes at the St. John Coltrane African Orthodox Church, which is facing eviction.
When you discover the possibilities of music, you want to help humanity, you want to help free people from their hang-ups.
Will they find a new place to worship? Then what happens when values and culture are shifting in your neighborhood?
You gotta talk about it to people and have conversations, pláticas, you know?
And we hear from San Francisco's poet laureate about the mission in the 1970s.
The mission was like a little Latin American pueblo.
What's happening to San Francisco? You'll hear about it today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. One of San Francisco's cultural icons is facing eviction. It's the St. John Coltrane African Orthodox Church. The church is currently on Fillmore Street in the heart of San Francisco's Jazz Preservation District. The city dedicated millions of dollars just over a decade ago to revitalize the neighborhood, once known as the Harlem of the West. But the anchor tenant, Yoshi's Jazz Club and Restaurant, filed for bankruptcy in 2012 and was sold 2 years later. So the music isn't playing quite so loud anymore. Last week, the San Francisco Sheriff's Department served the Coltrane Church with notice that it must leave by Wednesday. Again, it comes down to money. Tomorrow, church leaders are planning to meet with city officials to see if they can be allowed more time to move. The church has not paid rent to its landlord, the West Bay Conference Center, for over a year. In this story from our archives, reporter Christina Loring went to the Church of Coltrane and brought back this report.
It's Sunday morning, and while the Fillmore District is brunching or sleeping in, I'm sweating to attend something I've never run for in my life, church. I'm hoofing it past hair salons, fast food chains, corner markets, and thrift stores to catch the start of Mass. Just up the street from an abandoned pool hall and a windowless police station, I come across what looks like a dormant storefront window. I almost pass it, but I check the address again. I've arrived. I walk into the studio-sized space and am immediately greeted by a dauntingly huge mural of a Black Mary and Jesus. This isn't your typical cathedral with marble and stained glass. There aren't any pews, just rows of chairs facing the front of the room. Before the mural is an altar of instruments. An electric upright bass cozies up to a wooden pulpit. There's a full drum set, a keyboard, a saxophone. Suddenly, a procession of church members emerges from behind a curtain next to the stage. I've made it just in time. This is the African Orthodox Church of John Coltrane. I notice the usual fare, a table with a Bible and sacraments. But on the wall to the left of that is something you won't see in any other church. A floor-to-ceiling painting of John Coltrane holding a scripture in one hand and a saxophone in the other, with a glowing gold halo around his head. This holy Coltrane watches over a cluster of 30 churchgoers. They're a mix of jazz tourists from abroad and local regulars, all clutching tambourines, maracas, and mini hand drums. A ritual jam session begins. The church calls it the Coltrane Liturgy. This means taking the Lord's Prayer and readings from the Gospel and lacing them with their fiery performances of Coltrane's compositions. The small congregation is on its feet, led by a three-woman chorus leaning into their mics with their hands raised to the heavens. The Church of John Coltrane has always put the man's music at the center of its services.
I hear John Coltrane say, you know, when you discover the possibilities of music, you want to help humanity, you want to help free people from their hang-ups and make the world a better place. And so that's the kind of intention that he had behind his music.
That's Wanika King Stevens. Her father, Franzo King, founded the church decades ago after he took his wife, Marina, to see Coltrane play.
Thank you.
San Francisco was a hotbed for jazz at the time, with smoke-filled clubs and a rotating cast of musical greats. The Kings were at a popular club in North Beach, the Jazz Workshop. That night, Fronzo King experienced what he calls his sound baptism.
Going to see Train, you had great expectations in the first place. But I think that the most obvious thing that I can remember is the atmosphere around his being. There was something very obviously different about John's walk, his presence. I couldn't liken him to nothing other than a Pentecostal preacher. I like to say it was like being caught up in a rainstorm. We didn't know if it was going to bring flowers or floods, but it brought both. You know, it flooded our heart with the divine love of God, and it planted seeds that grew into what we now call the St. John Coltrane Church.
John Coltrane wasn't always a saint. He was born in 1926 to a North Carolina family of musicians and ministers. He picked up the clarinet and then the tenor sax. After high school, he joined the Navy and made his first recording. He eventually moved to New York, where he played with jazz greats Jimmy Heath, Dizzy Gillespie, and Miles Davis. But as Coltrane hit his musical stride, he also developed a heroin addiction. He was falling asleep at shows. Davis fired him. Coltrane saw this as a wake-up call. The year was 1957. He retreated to his mother's house for a few weeks. Something of a jazz scene cleanse. And he had a realization of a deeper philosophy, as shared in this interview, recorded in Japan in 1966.
I believe that our men are to, are here to grow themselves into the best good that they can be. At least this is what I want to do. And, you know, when I, as I'm going there, becoming this, and when I become, if I ever become, this will just come out of the horn. So whatever that's going to be, that's what it will be. Good can only bring good.
Coltrane changed the way the Kings thought about music. He transformed jazz into spiritual enlightenment. Fronzo King was sitting in Marcus Bookstore in the Fillmore in 1967 when he learned of Coltrane's passing. It was another awakening for him. It was time to act. The Kings had a listening club, a place to meditate on music. They studied Coltrane's sound and how it related to scripture.
We saw ourselves as the prayerful vigilantes coming together at midnight to listen to St. John's music and be prayerful.
The congregants began considering themselves a church, and the cornerstone would be Coltrane's album, A Love Supreme. Coltrane wrote the iconic liner notes to that album himself.
And I think that the way he endears the listener by opening up a dear listener, and he gives praise to God, all praise be to God, to whom all praise is due. Yes, it is true, seek and ye shall find. Only through him can we know the most wonders bestowed. Now, coming from a Christian discipline, when he said, he quotes Jesus there, seek and ye shall find, and then he says, only through him can we know the most wonders bestowed. It suggested to us that he was pointing us toward Christ.
To the Church of Coltrane, everything about that album is part of a higher power. The titles, the compositions, the consciousness.
I would say Coltrane consciousness is the divine formula.
This is Fronzo King's daughter, Marley Eye. Her roles in the church range from choir singer to outreach to drummer in the band.
Acknowledgement, resolution, pursuance, to reach a love supreme. So acknowledge God, resolve to do all you can, and continually pursue every day. That's Coltrane consciousness. If you follow those steps, that's it. Coltrane gave us the key.
Marley Eye's older sister, Wanika King Stevens, has served as church pastor for the last few years.
For me, Coltrane consciousness is about just being about that word, consciousness, to be awake, to be aware, and then not just aware of what's going on with yourself personally, but what's going on around you, and being aware of the fact that there's one universe.
During services, Pastor Wanika will deliver the gospel from behind the pulpit, then pick up an electric bass, joining her dad on sax. When she was a child, the Kings moved services out of their home and into a storefront on Divisadero Street near Oak. It was 1971. The spot was across the street from the site of the Both and Club, where Billie Holiday, Miles Davis, and Coltrane himself performed.
When we got there in the 70s, early 70s, it was pretty much a ghost town. And so it was pretty much us and the hippies.
That's because the Western Addition had been the center of urban renewal in the 60s. Justin Herman, the city's head of redevelopment at the time, had a new plan to clean up the rundown buildings of the area. By the time the Coltrane Church arrived on the scene, 10,000 residents had been displaced. Jazz heritage and black culture were crushed in the rubble of bulldozed buildings.
And I remember when Dr. Huey P. Newton came out of prison.
The vanguard group of the revolution doesn't have strength other than the strength of the people.
And he was on the radio and he was saying that the churches had really failed us.
And that the black community should be a haven for the leaders and a stronghold for protection.
That the churches need to be more relevant and they need to be more concerned about the survival of the people and this, that, and another. And I go, I know what kind of church he's talking about. He's talking about my church, you know.
King leans in toward me. His eyes get wide when he recalls the food programs they held with the Black Panther Party. This was a time when many socio-spiritual groups were growing in the Bay Area. Hare Krishnas, the Moonies. Jim Jones's People's Temple was right next to the Fillmore Auditorium before relocating to Guyana.
And if you're not getting persecution, you're not living godly. So I have my credentials. What about you?
After the Jonestown Massacre in 1978, people were suspicious of a church that worshipped John Coltrane. King says the influence of African-American leaders helped his church survive this intense era. And in 1982, the Church of Coltrane became part of the African Orthodox Church. The Coltrane Church would face more challenges. Its neighborhood gentrified. Residents and business owners promised a shinier space by redevelopment could no longer afford their homes. The church's rent doubled.
It had been a struggle. You know, we had been there, we didn't want to leave the place.
Marley I. Hand remembers the church's departure from the neighborhood in 2000 when she was about to leave for college. For her, though, it wasn't an ending, but a rebirth.
And we had a march. We just paraded all the way down the street, singing praises to the Lord from the old site to the new site. And that was wonderful. You know, we had marched and done different things, but just that whole transition of physically moving the spirit and the praise from one place to another, that was a great memory for me.
Today, the church is nestled in the heart of the Lower Fillmore. I've heard people recall when the area was the Harlem of the West, but I've never recognized the connection. Now I understand why the parallels seem so faint to me. When they forced much of the black community out, they also evicted the culture. Sometimes I see evidence if I look closely. I can see tiles in the cement with the names of jazz legends of that time. Sometimes there's a jazz band at the Sunday Farmers Market. Echoes of another era.
That piece was produced by Christina Loring. It first aired in May 2013. Just last week, the St. John Coltrane African Orthodox Church was ordered to leave its current home by the Sheriff's Department. Their deadline to move is this Wednesday. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. A couple miles south of the Coltrane Church lives Roberto Hernandez. He's a leader of the Our Mission, No Eviction campaign, and he's seen plenty of change come to his neighborhood, too. A lot of people in his community have been forced to leave the mission over the last few years. In this piece from San Francisco's StoryCorps, Hernandez speaks with Young Mission District local Akia Muster about the changes they've seen in their neighborhood.
My whole life took place here in the mission, you know. My grandpa worked at SF General for 45 years. The reason why he loved living here and walking on 24th Street was because it reminded him of growing up as a kid in Nicaragua. People would say hi to you. You know, you get a little pan dulce. And I had that as a kid, kind of, when I would walk with him everywhere we go. I think, in a way, they've already taken over the mission. And it's not about race. To be racist, it's not anything like that. It really is, I believe, a white thing.
They don't talk to you, they don't acknowledge you. And it's funny because, you know, on my block, we've had, you know, 7 families that have been evicted. And on my block, I every time somebody got evicted, every time somebody moved in, I'd go in and introduce myself, right? And tell them I'm the captain of the block and I watch out for everybody on the block. And they look at me like I'm crazy, you know? If it was a Latino family that moved in, right, I welcome them and they invite me in. You know what I'm saying? All 7 white folks that moved into the block, not one has invited me inside their home. That's a difference. It's a cultural thing.
Yeah. You understand that, what a neighborhood means when it's your only neighborhood, when it's the only place you can speak Spanish to somebody in a little tienda. And I think they don't understand that when they come in. They don't understand the privilege of being able to see white people no matter where you go, in positions of power, positions of influence. And the only place that that exists for us in the city is in the mission, that you see people, business owners that are Latino, or supervisors like David Campos or John Avalos, that they're Latino. And to see that we're together and they come in here and they disrespect that, and it's like they're peeing on it. Like, they don't care. They don't acknowledge the fact that we are a people here. It just makes me really mad and sad, you know.
I learned this from Cesar Chavez because I was an organizer for him. I remember getting angry and he would say, you know what, you got to take that anger and you got to use that anger to cause change. And you gotta talk about it to people and have conversations, pláticas, you know? So that's what I've been doing. I've just been talking to every time I see somebody new that's not involved, say, hey, brother, did you hear? I know you know about these evictions. What are you gonna do about it? How are you gonna get involved?
That story was produced by Truk Nguyen and facilitated by Sophia Simon Ortiz. And now we'd like to share a piece from our friends at the Litography Project.
The Litography Project!
Shh. Your guide to the literary Bay Area.
The Litography Project airs stories about literary culture and history in the Bay Area. Producer Martina Castro took a walk around the Mission with San Francisco's poet laureate Alejandro Murguia to hear about what the neighborhood used to be like when he moved here back in the 1970s and what's changed. Here's the first part of their tour.
Stray poems. These poems are for the community of the Mission District, La Misión, San Pancho, mi gente, mi pueblo.
How would you represent yourself?
Well, I'm Alejandro Murguia, and I've been accused of being a poet. And we're here at 15th and Valencia in front of the Hotel Royan, the Mission's finest.
There's nothing fine about the gray and brown building in front of us. But when Alejandro Murguia starts to tell me its story, the faded red cursive sign comes alive against the crumbling gray backdrop. It's like I see it more. And that's why I'm here, to learn the stories behind these nondescript buildings. Murguia sees them in every corner, storefront, and bus stop. They instantly take him back to when he first arrived in La Misión. It was the early 1970s.
The Mission was like a little Latin American pueblo. It really had that feeling that, oh, you knew everybody and all the different sort of characters you might find in a novel by García Márquez.
All of these unique characters were working together, Murguia says.
Working from all sorts of issues, from housing, to drug problems, and of course, a great, great cultural ambiance.
Of activists, artists, and authors, even here at the Hotel Royan. For example, Oscar Zeta Acosta was a civil rights attorney and writer. He wrote a novel here.
One of the great novels of United States literature, The Revolt of the Cockroach People. And in fact, he signs it, you know, the Hotel Royan, the Mission's finest.
Yes, me, the big chingon, I, Mr. Buffalo Z. Brown, me.
That's Acosta in 1973, describing the disgust he felt after witnessing another autopsy of one of his clients.
For the rest of my born days, I will suffer the knowledge of your death and your second death and your ashes to my ashes, your dust to my dust. Goodbye, ese. Viva la raza.
In 1974, Oscar Zeta Acosta disappeared and was never heard from again. His boisterous, larger-than-life persona left its mark on the Chicano movement, the Mexican-American movement in California. But look around here for a clue, and there's nothing to remind you of his life and his work. Murguia hopes to memorialize him here at the Hotel Royan. He wants a plaque to commemorate it as the site where Acosta wrote his last novel. Until then, Murguia honors him the best way he knows how, through his poetry. Here's Homage for the Cockroach Poet.
Fire up that ball of Nepalese temple hash and let the jazz flow under the pork pie hats. Let the suits swing their high notes. Let the vatos float their lowriders, let the rucas sigh their sighs, and let the conch shells blow, hard and mighty, the cockroach anthem for the cockroach poet. And gather all los más chingones, los más danzantes, los más guerreros, las más valientes y las más poetas, a cantar himnos de lucha y justicia. Carve them in our own stone calendars. Our historic years, our heroes, heroines, poets, warriors. This is who we were. Here's how we fought, with pen in hand, sometimes otherwise. So let the sacred smoke flow. Let the ancient drums beat. Let's sing the holy songs of struggle. Let's raise our clenched fist in last salute. Corazón en lucha, bright this dawning in the east side of Austin, in San Antos, in La Misión, in Sacra, La Loma, all live etched eternally in your epic howl, llanto, dream, travel trip to recover the barrio that is all the barrios of the universe. And now the drum beat of the poet starts the cycle of life moving again in this barrio and the next, forever firme. Hail the cockroach poet, Ike.
That piece originally aired in February 2015. To hear more stories from the Litography Project, go to litographyproject.com. Do you live in a changing neighborhood? We'd love to hear about it. Email us at news@kalw.org or leave us a message at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. Because of you, we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Geraldine Asu, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Tammy Drummond, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Casey Miner, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by James Rowlands. The line producer was Liz Mack. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Today's local music is by I Refuse from Marin County. I Refuse has a free show on Wednesday night at Sweetwater Music Hall in Mill Valley. They start playing at 10. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.